right, everybody, welcome. This is Project Herpetoculture Podcast, and I'm your host, Roy Arthur Blodgett, joined as always by the inimitable Philip Leitz of Arids Only. And we have an excellent show for you today. We're excited to dive into it, but before we do, we've got our standard housekeeping. So first, I want to give a shout out to Dylan and the Animals at Home Network for hosting our show. It continues to be a pleasure to be a part of this network. Next, I want to give a shout out to Charlie for editing our audio and keeping us on the rails over here, making this a listenable experience for everybody. Huge shout out to him. We really appreciate him and his help. And next, I want to take this opportunity to talk about our sponsors. So first, we have Custom Reptile Habitats. They've been with us since day one, and they produce premium PVC reptile enclosures. I use them for a lot of the large format vivaria here. They also carry Universal Rocks, Miss King products, and a bunch of other useful stuff. So if you're in the market for any of that and you're planning to make a purchase, consider doing so through the link in our bio or description, and we'll receive a small commission at no additional cost to you. That really helps us keep the lights on over here.
Next, we have Fairy Tale Dragons. This is the collaborative effort between Heather Moy and Ron St. Pierre, both of whom need no introduction and have achieved legendary status in herpetoculture. They've accomplished a lot and produce some of the finest bearded dragons and Tahlequah in the country, as well as a whole host of other species, including some very interesting emerald tree boa and green tree python projects. Check them out if you're in the market for any of that cool stuff, and be sure to follow along with them on social media. They're always something interesting, and you can learn a lot paying attention.
Next, we have Cold-Blooded Caffeine, and they're roasters of delicious coffees from all over the globe. We have a private label with them, the PH Blend, which is a light roast coffee from Rwanda. It's a great choice for those who prefer more floral coffee with notes of berry and fruit, but they have a wide variety of options for a broad array of preferences. So check them out. And if you place an order, don't forget to use the code PROJECTHERP for 10% off.
We are also very pleased to have the support of Exoterra, a brand that needs no introduction. It's safe to say that herpetoculture would not be where it is today without the influence of Exoterra. For decades, they've been industry leader in innovation, offering just about everything needed for reptile care, from diets and supplements, enclosures, lighting, and substrates. We're both big fans of their naturalistic terraria and substrates in particular, and they have a lot of interesting projects and works as we speak, and we're really looking forward to seeing what comes next.
And last but not least, we have Tamura Designs. For those in the know, Tamura Designs is widely regarded as one of the finest enclosure manufacturers on the planet. They produce outstanding large format Bavaria with endless options for customization. Drains, UV printed backgrounds, lighting rigs, and on top of all of that, they also make amazing deli cup displays, and they make these incredible multi-unit condos, which I use a lot here. So if you're interested in any of that and you decide to make a purchase, use the code Herpetoculture for 15% off one item. That's a special offer for our listeners. We're really thankful to all our sponsors for signing on to support the show.
And finally, if you're interested in supporting the show directly, something of a tip or a monthly donation, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/projectherpetoculture. We have a monthly live chat that we host for all of our subscribers that has been a great deal of fun so far. We also have a cool line of merchandise, t-shirts, mugs, pint glasses, and more can be found on our website. And of course, sharing the show with a friend, subscribing on YouTube, and keeping up with on social media is always helpful.
And with all that said, we're on to the show. So Corey Martin is our guest today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, usually thanks so Phil, much for having me.
Yeah, of course. My pleasure. I mean, usually Phil would be here as well, but he had to cancel last minute. He's got some stuff going on. So we're going to be flying just you and me tonight. And I'm stoked to talk to you.
Yeah, same.
I really appreciate you making the time.
Yeah, thank
and,
you.
Yeah, of course. My pleasure. So to begin, I'd love to just hear, like, what's your herpetoculture origin story? How did it all start for you?
Yeah, so it actually started, I mean, I originally had a, you know, bearded dragon as my first thing, like a lot of people. But and it was really my son. I have a couple of kids who are on the autism spectrum, and one of them was really struggling, and he had this thing where he wanted a snake. And for the longest time, I was like, no, man, we're not getting a snake, like anything but a snake. And then he hit this point where we really needed to find a way to motivate him. And we went out and ended up getting him a ball python. And I thought it was the coolest thing on the freaking planet. I had had very little experience with snakes at that point. Had always been an animal person, but not a lot of reptile experience. And I don't know, kind of went off the deep end at that point, and started with like the big ball python collection. Pretty quickly, after about 6 months of doing that, I got into carpet pythons and had a pretty extensive carpet python collection. I bred hognose for a little while. And then I'm about 5 years into it now. And over the past year, I have been working on a really significant transition and change of direction. I got my first monitor lizards, and I just was like, all of a sudden, man, this is what I'm supposed to be working with. And have been working pretty hard over the past year building my group of lizards and downsizing from all of the ball python and snake madness. And I'm at the point right now, as of yesterday, I finally sold all the ball pythons, and I'm, wow. Yeah, which is like a huge relief. It's been something that I thought was going to take probably a couple of years. And so, at this point I've got a much smaller collection than I used to have, and it's just a bunch of lizards at my house, and I love it.
Amazing. Yeah. That's a pretty amazing story.
Just lost my
That's okay. Wow. I'm super curious about like this, like when did it transition for you from like, okay, we have a ball python, you know, yeah, that you got for your kiddo. And then at some point, like when did the kind of transition occur where you were like, maybe I should start kind of doing this at like a different scale and like breeding and producing and like kind of moving in more of like a business direction with it as well?
So for me, I think it was pretty fast. And I think that was for a couple of reasons. One was just because my origin was in the ball python world. And that direction is something that seems to be pretty common in that subsector of the hobby. And so that was just kind of what I was around. Then also in the context of all the stuff that was going on with my son at the time, I had to leave my job and because he was missing so much school. Mm. And I just was at the time just like really looking for something to do with my life that wasn't like taking care of kids. And so it was just kind of like this perfect storm of like the reptile thing appeared. And and it just kind of, it went to a larger scale pretty quickly. I think the second year of keeping, I produced 10 clutches of eggs.
Wow.
Yeah. And then it like, I think the most I ever, my biggest season was last year. I produced about 45 clutches of eggs, and It almost killed me. It was, it was so many babies. It was at the time I was still working a full-time job. I've since started doing all this reptile stuff full-time, nice. Which is a whole other thing we can talk about, but like, it was too much. And that was the point where I realized, okay, quantity is not going to be the thing for me. I need to really focus on, what can I do that is bringing me the most enjoyment out of this and is really serving the animals better. And so that ended up being a pretty significant change in direction for me, as well as around the same time I started traveling and doing going on herping trips and doing wildlife photography. And I just started learning, I guess, other ways to interact with and appreciate the animals that I love other than keeping. And for me, that was like a really big turning point, because I was like, oh, I don't have to just have all of these animals to appreciate them and enjoy them. Like, there are other ways to, be a herp person and have them in your life other than keeping them in boxes at your house. So,
yeah, that's a familiar trajectory. I feel like most of us at some point have the experience of getting in over our heads.
Yep.
And like getting overwhelmed, getting burnt out, and then having to kind of reassess. And I was lucky in that I was still a teenager kind of when I experienced that initially. Yeah. And then I had like 10 years away from the hobby through my 20s, and then getting back into it in my late 20s, early 30s now. I'm trying to like just always keep that awareness in the back of my mind of like, don't get in over your head, you know, and just like try and go slow. And like, I have to like impose limits on myself.
Yeah.
Cause otherwise I know that I'll just, it's just so compelling. There's so much excitement to it.
Yep.
I totally relate to that experience of like herping and like also enjoying other people's collections as a way to kind of like,
yes,
scratch the same itch, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. It's been really interesting how it's evolved. And I think related to that, like, it's one of the things I really like about having a collection that's so focused on small monitor lizards, like tree monitors in particular now, is their enclosures take up so much room.
Yep.
And so that in and of itself, like, is a natural limit. Mm-hmm. In terms of like how big a collection can reasonably be. And for me, that's a good thing.
Yeah, totally. I relate. I have two little reptile rooms right now. And there's this one and then the other one, and the other one's a bigger one, and it's 120 square feet, and I have 5 enclosures in there. And that's
okay. Yeah.
It's like, that's
awesome.
Because it's just, it's the same thing. It's like, a lot of that space is taken up by Amazon puffing snakes, and they need a lot of space.
Oh yeah.
So, that alone limits, you know, what I can do. And I'm, more often than not, I'm grateful for that, for the way that that works out in my favor.
Yeah. I've also discovered just the joy of creating enclosures and all of that too. So, it's been a cool process for me the past few years to just realize that there's a lot more to it and a lot of ways that like feel, I guess, more comfortable and authentic to me to keep animals and to just have them be part of my life. So
yeah, totally. I really appreciate that perspective, because it's, you know, I think it's really easy to, in herpetoculture, like get into it and then see what like the big names are doing, and then like be like, that's what I have to do.
Yeah.
You know, like, or like that's the path. And I think that there's other ways to participate in herpetoculture that that are at different scales, you know, and like for different niches and different needs and I that's one of the reasons why I like to have this podcast, is I like to talk to people from every different aspect of herpetoculture, from people who literally have like 5 reptiles or 1 reptile, you know, to people who have 500, because it's all herpetoculture,
you know,
and you can learn valuable things on any end of that spectrum. So, one thing I'm curious about in this whole arc of yours is if like kind of coming into it, like what were some of the, like, did you have any mentors or like inspirations that you were looking toward or resources that you were looking toward as you were building up your collection?
Yeah. So, I live in Texas, and I was very lucky coming in that we have a very, very strong hobby in Texas. And I was, you know, on the ball python side. Yeah, I mean, I kind of fell in with a group of people pretty early. We all vend together, which is wonderful because I'm usually alone vending. And so if I have to run to the bathroom or get a snack or whatever, like someone can watch my table. And so anyway, so I've kind of always had that, which has been like super helpful and wonderful. And, you know, also people were, when I was doing ball pythons, I could call up and be like, you know, hey, I can't identify this. Like, what do you think, you know, what morphs do you think this one has? Or, you know, that kind of thing. And so that was always super, super helpful. And yeah, other than that, like I was also very lucky. I met a few, of the, I guess, like bigger name people early on, Billy Rose up at Mutation Creation in Canada. He was an early person who like was just always very, very nice to me. I went up and visited his place, like, I don't know, several facilities ago, like way, way back, probably to that, like 2020, probably. And so I just had, I've had a few people like that, just kind of like be unnecessarily nice and help me along. And it's something that I really try to make a conscious effort to pay forward now that I'm kind of at a different place in my journey.
For sure. Yeah, that's really cool to hear. I feel like there's so much that is voiced about kind of like gatekeeping in the hobby, which I think is real. And it is like something to pay attention to. But at the same time, I do feel like herpetoculture is like, broadly speaking, much more welcoming of a community than like many others, and like much more accepting of a community in terms of like, you know, diversity and like neurodiversity and like things like that. Yes. You know, it's like that's all very welcome in herpetoculture in a way that I really appreciate.
Yeah, same, same. And yeah, I, you know, they're definitely like, you know, got into tiffs on Facebook groups and all that nonsense early on because that's just part of it. But there's also been, you know, kind of the whole Dunning-Kruger effect thing of like, I knew the most about reptiles like 6 months into my journey and now I feel like I know nothing. So.
Yeah. That sounds familiar. That sounds very familiar. Yeah. It's pretty funny how that works.
It's so funny, but yeah, I think it's one of the things that keeping a varied collection has helped me with a lot is, you know, the ability to like think outside of the box a little bit more when coming up for solutions with, you know, different scenarios, you know, that's been really, really useful. So.
Yeah, totally. I agree with that. I think that that's like, I know sometimes people talk about like the whole like Noah's Ark, you know, thing. Yeah. And like, I feel like that's often talked about in a way it's like kind of biting or derogatory or something, you know, like, oh, it's a Noah's Ark. But I think that that's actually like, I think that that's kind of an essential like stage for a lot of people because you're like, you're just, you know, you're sponging up so much information about different taxa that can then be broadly applied to like whole other, you know, aspects of herpetoculture. And I just think that that can be really, really valuable.
Yeah,
I know that for me, you know, as a youngster coming in, it was like, I was pretty indiscriminate about my interest in herpetoculture. It was like, it's like, if it's a cool reptile, and especially if it's a cool reptile that I've never heard of before, then like, I want to learn everything I can about it.
Yes.
And that's broadly still true, but with a little bit more focus, a little bit more self-control maybe.
I kind of went broad, and then I feel like I'm going back more narrow at this point.
Yeah.
And part of that is just realizing I only have so many hours in my day. You know, lizards and snakes have wildly different care needs. And I was feeling like, you know, the tree monitors are my thing, and like they're what the thing that I value most in my collection. It's like, it's a huge, huge deal to me. And I was feeling like I was spending so much time, like just doing regular maintenance stuff on the snakes, that I wasn't able to give them as much focus as I needed, just in terms of like not like just keeping up with regular care, but stuff like paying attention to subtle behavioral differences. You know, that kind of thing, which can provide just really, really important clues for how the animals are doing and whether certain parameters need to be changed or whatever. And so I hit a point where I was like, by spreading myself so broadly, I'm limiting my ability to do this thing that is the thing I really care about. And so that kind of led to my current refocusing back down.
Yeah, totally. So I want to talk to you about that, but yeah. I'm also curious about this, this kind of like transition that you spoke to of like, yeah. you know, going from, you know, having a full-time job and doing herpetoculture to now herpetoculture is your full-time job. So how did that transition happen? Was it horrifying? Was it exciting? Was it all of the above? I'm like really curious.
Yeah. So it's something I went back and forth on a really long time. And then it ultimately ended up being not even really a decision to go full time into reptiles, but I'm completely burned out at my job and need to not be doing this anymore kind of thing. And it just kind of, I had a pretty successful reptile business at the time. So I was like, all right, I'll just do this. And you know, I'm in a fortunate position at this point in time where, you know, my husband, you know, brings in enough money that my family doesn't need me to sell reptiles in order to eat dinner. And mm-hmm. so, that also created a bit more flexibility than like yeah. a lot of people would have. And, that's, I don't know. And so anyway, so it was super nerve-wracking. I also made the decision to open up a facility within about 6 months of going full time, which in retrospect was not my greatest decision. but it was definitely a real wild ride, but it was really that summer where I had 45 clutches and they were like all landing at the same time. And I was working a full-time job and my job was, I was a lawyer and I was doing like, I don't know, like 14 hearings a week. And it was just like, life was chaotic and crazy. And so, I really, really like, it was a needed thing to dial back. I don't know where I was going with that, but.
Oh, just the transition towards.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was nerve-wracking and scary. And all of the above, early on, I felt like, I needed to like keep production up at a certain point in order to like, you know, justify all of it. And that's kind of evolved over time. The downturn in the ball python market definitely like, forced a little bit of like rethinking and refocusing some stuff. But yeah, it's been interesting. Mm-hmm. I really like, you know, having all of the time to deal with stuff and work on stuff. You know, it's the same issues that, you know, you run into any situation where you're working for yourself is, you know, I've got all the time. How am I going to, you know, structure it and all of that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I took some time to figure out. But yeah, in general, I've been really happy with it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious about your facility. So you said is this like a structure that on your property that you, where you live, or are you renting something, or what's the situation with that?
So I rented warehouse space. Cool. It's at like a storage facility place where they also have like shops
nice.
that people can do. And so I rented that. It's like 1,000 square feet. And I put all of my animals in there to begin with. Then pretty quickly realized, well, not pretty quickly, over the course of a few months, realized the hard way that it was not a secure facility for lizards.
Oh, yeah.
My and I'll get into this whole story too, but my female black tree monitor, I was spraying her cage one day. She bolted within 2 minutes. she was just gone, like gone. I heard her in the walls. I heard her in the ceiling, like the 14 feet up. And then it was silent. And I was like certain she got out of the building. Thank God, a week and a half later, my next door neighbor in the facility, in the unit, he found her in his facility. And so I was able to recover her. I was actually pretty amazed because I got a call from the management like, hey, are you by any chance missing a black tree monitor? Like they called it, they knew what it was, which I was like super impressed by.
Yeah, I was going to say that's pretty cool.
So I ended up recovering her. So it all ended up being like a not horrible, sad story, but like it was a real big wake up call for me. And I moved all of my lizards home that weekend. So now I've been running a split facility where my snakes have been over there and my lizards have been at home. And then that has over time gotten very expensive for a place that only really works for half my collection.
Right.
And so at this point, instead of keeping all of that going, I ended up deciding to let the snake stuff go for now.
And
so I don't have that ongoing expense and I'm just going to focus on the lizards. So
that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So that's where we are now. I have all the snakes sold. I'm still holding on to several of them while people, you know, make preparations and all that sort of thing. But within the next few months, I'll be able to close all that down and back home. So it's kind of
very cool.
I don't know. It's like, I've often been one of those people where I've got to like learn stuff by going through it. And I definitely learned that like the big facility, like, you know, very large collection, all that stuff, it just like turned something I enjoyed into so much work that it stopped being fun. And the thing that was wonderful with finding the monitors and getting into that was all of a sudden I had fun in reptiles again. And so that's what I'm chasing now.
Very cool. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely something about like, again, just like that whole question of scale, you know? And I think especially if you're working with species like ball pythons, you know, and it's like mostly like, you know, oriented toward rack style keeping. Yep. And it's like, it's like, when I think about like, okay, what's the other end of the spectrum of that? I would think tree monitors.
Yes. polar opposite. It's so true.
So it totally makes sense that like, that you're kind of like, you know, again, in this process of sampling what's out there, what works for you. So let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Like what about it? What about tree monitors? I mean, I'm sure I have all kinds of ideas, but in your words, what about tree monitors? What about kind of those guys draws you to them?
So what I love about them, one, their size is amazing. They, you know, they're substantial enough that I'm not like terrified that it's going to run away and I'm never going to find it. But they're not so big that like I'm nervous about handling it. So like size wise, I think they're amazing. They're so smart. Like you can watch them and see the wheels turning. Like they know things and they pay attention to you and what you're doing and change their behaviors according to that. And, I just like find that so interesting and so fascinating. And then they're out and doing goofy things. And they're just so fun to watch. We have my pair of green tree monitors in my family room right now. And like, we all just sit there and watch them like, you know, dive bomb from the top of their cage or whatever nonsense they're doing. And it's just so enjoyable.
So cool.
Yeah.
When you were kind of starting out with your tree monitors, were you working with wild caught or did you like get captive bred and born specifically?
Most of my stuff right now is wild caught. I started putting together a blue tree monitor group about 6 months ago and all of that is captive born. I also have some captive black babies coming from Canada in a few months as I try to develop that whole project. They're the ones right now that I'm just like super pumped and super excited about. in particular. I also guess I like the challenge of them too, that like, they're not, you know, they're not massively widely, you know, produced in captivity right now. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like this opportunity to do something where like, I can actually kind of make a difference in the world. Yeah. In terms of like, you know, if we can create a captive market for these animals, then like less demand for imported and less need to like take these animals from, you know, their, you know, small populations in the wild and that sort of thing. So that's also part of, I guess, what I really like about them too.
Yeah, totally. I mean, especially with like these insular species, you know, where they have like such restricted ranges, you know, it's like, we actually had an earlier episode with Brian from Sundown about, and we talked a lot about just like the significance of like the conservation implications of tree monitors and like,
absolutely.
The wild populations can't sustain the current captive demand. And like in that, there's both like obviously some tragic aspects, but there's also this opportunity for those of us who are serious about it to really make a difference, like you're saying. Yeah, so it's really cool to hear that. And yeah, I think that I have this kind of arbitrary rule that I've made for myself that I only work with stuff from the Western hemisphere. But if I, if I ever betray that, it's probably going to be for tree monitors. Just because they're so
I don't know. I feel like there's a whole lot
so much going for them.
I feel like there's so many Western hemisphere animals that are totally underappreciated in the hobby. So
totally. And which is kind of part of why I go for that too, is there's so much stuff from like, you know, neotropics that
absolutely
is not established at all yet. And it's still available. And so but anyway. So you just had a pretty exciting event happen.
Yes. So I just hatched out a clutch of black tree monitors. And so that is actually my first clutch of monitors to hatch. And so I know, right?
Way to start it off, you know, just jumping right over the ackies and all that stuff going for black trees.
Yeah. I wasn't really, I don't know. I wasn't really expecting it. So these animals, I bought them, they're both wild caught, but I bought them as really like long-term captive animals from two different people who had them for like a year plus. And so they were really settled into captivity by the time I got them.
Nice.
And I just lucked out into putting two animals together that are really, really into each other. And so, like, they are pretty inseparable in their cage, like all the time.
Nice.
Not all my tree monitors are like that, but these two, like, he looks out for her. He makes sure she gets enough food. The time where she bolted, he was real concerned about where she was hiding, was like looking all around the enclosure, trying to find her. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so they're really, really into each other. And, yeah, I was really surprised to find them mating. And then I was really, really surprised to get a clutch. And then I was really surprised a month later to find veins to see that it was viable. And then it was like everywhere along this whole thing, like I was expecting something to go wrong. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the blacks in particular are like kind of notoriously difficult to breed. There aren't a whole lot of people like having a great amount of success with them in the US. And I've heard all sorts of horror stories from other people about, you know, all sorts of things going wrong at different points. And I was like, man, this is my first time doing this. Like, I am of course going to mess things up, but this will be a learning opportunity and I'll do better the next time. That was kind of my mindset this whole way. So I was stunned to finally get to the end and be like, oh my God, these things are hatching. And I ended up having to call up someone to be like, so it looks like I'm actually going to be getting babies. What do I do for the babies? Because I wasn't like prepared for this whole thing of like, I'm going to have babies. I need to learn how to start them, all of that sort of thing. Because I was so sure I wasn't going to get them. So anyway, it's really, really awesome. All four eggs hatched. They're all doing really well. Looks like they're all eating at this point. and have a second clutch in the incubator. Mom and dad are mating again now. I have at this point 2 green tree monitor clutches in the incubator.
Nice.
And an Aki clutch in the incubator too. So yeah, so it's just kind of like, I don't know, it just kind of got going and I was really surprised.
That's so cool. So what was the incubation duration for that clutch, the black trees?
So it was 162 days.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly how long my first clutch of Polychrus marmoratus were, the little common monkey lizards. It was also.
Oh, wow. I didn't
know. So I know how agonizing that weight is.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the whole time you're like, man, it's like, are they too wet? Are they too dry? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, all of that. And so, it was a long time, almost half a year, but, I think as, you know, I continue with this and get going, they can produce as frequently as every 3 months or so. And from what I've heard from a lot of people is kind of once your female kind of gets going into that cycle, she'll just kind of stay in that cycle. And so, you know, at some point I'll just be like, kind of have eggs at all different stages of incubation. And every once in a while I'll get a clutch hatch. And I think it won't feel as like long for weights as it did for that very first one.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Cause you'll have, they'll just kind of be in a rhythm now, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Especially with black trees too. Cause yeah, like you said, it's, I feel like of the tree monitors, like black trees, cordensis, and like boa are the ones that I very, very rarely see.
Oh gosh, hatched. Boa like Brian has a clutch of those. I'm like really rooting.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I'd love to see those get hatched out. Yeah. It'd be really cool. That's awesome. What is, I'm curious about a little bit to hear about like your husbandry for the trees. Like what is your, how do you set them up? And also I'm curious about like your kind of like routines with them. Like, are you into automation and like misting systems? Do you want to do everything by hand? What's your kind of
philosophy there? So this is a super fun conversation. So, up until about this week, I've been doing everything by hand. And that's mainly just been because I have them scattered all over my house, and putting together a misting system has seemed like I would have to have like 5 different misting systems.
Yeah.
I did put my ones in my living room on a misting system this past week, and it's amazing and I love it. And I ordered a big Mist King for all the ones in my dining room. And so we'll...
Nice.
I'm going to be moving more toward that just because, just knowing that it's covered is
great.
So right now, my adult animals are in 4x2x4s. I have some 4x2x6s ordered. And I'm looking forward to kind of seeing how they use the space differently. I've heard mixed things about it. Some people are kind of the perspective that they're only using the top part of the enclosure anyway. So that bottom part is kind of wasted space and it creates more issues with keeping humidity at the right levels and like keeping heat at the right levels, especially if you have like a nest box at the bottom and you've got to keep temperatures in that really good. So I've heard that from some people. I've heard from other people that, they really appreciate having the extra space. So I'm really curious to see how that works out and, you know, from that decide kind of which direction I want to go longer term on them. In cages, just basic like UV light, halogen heat lamp for most of them. I'm super basic. I'm not doing anything related to like food cycling or light cycling or temp cycling or anything like that. My kind of thought on it is they're an equatorial species.
Yeah.
They're really having a dry season and a wet season as opposed to like a hot and cold season or that sort of thing. So, you know, going through periods of a little more dryness and a little more moisture might have something to do with it. But for an animal that breeds can breed every 3 months anyway, and isn't on an annual kind of breeding cycle. I don't know that all of that is like hugely important. So I was like, I'll just try without it. And then it's obvious, then it's something I have in my back pocket if I need to like fine tune things for a specific pair of animals or that sort of thing. So right now it's just 12 on, 12 off. Misting a couple times a day. Try to give them really, I tend to do pretty deep substrate. And then a really big water container that they can get in, mainly because humidity is just such a hard thing for me to maintain. I'm in Texas and, I feel like I'm just constant, especially this time of year, but like I'm constantly battling humidity. And so everything I can do in the cage to kind of like put that in my favor, I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, lots of cork. They love cork tubes. Most of mine nest inside cork tubes, and for the ones that are paired, the male has a cork tube he goes to, the female has a cork tube she goes to, except for those blacks, because they want to be together all the time. And yeah, I do fake plants because I'm not a plant person, and some people have had success with it. Some, I'm not good at keeping plants alive, like under like normal situations. So add in a bunch of monitors that want to like tear everything up, and like, I'm probably not doing a great job. So I have a lot of fake plants in my stuff, but yeah, nice. That's kind of how I have it set up. I feel like I'm constantly buying wood. I go to shows and I'm just like load up on wood.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that's an extra nice cork hollow right there. I'm going to have to take that one home.
Exactly.
I know how that goes. Yeah.
I found some really nice 6-foot poles recently, and I was like, oh my God, that'll be great for my big tall ones when they come. I was so excited.
Nice.
So yes. I just like, constantly buying, and I like use it all. Like the more I can put in their enclosures, like they use it all. So, they having lots of surfaces, I think is a really good thing. And then I have isopods in all of my cages. And they, make it so that I really don't have to do a huge amount of cleaning, which is wonderful. So,
yeah, that's such a nice change of pace with like lizards. Like you spoke to earlier, just like that kind of dynamic of, you know, like your interactions, you know, the tenor of them is mostly just like the basic maintenance, you know, which I think is really common for folks who keep snakes, particularly in the more traditional style of keeping snakes.
Absolutely.
But with lizards, it's like, especially if you're keeping bioactively, it's like all that time that you would normally be like spot cleaning and stuff like that can then be spent observing your animals and doing other things. That's something that I noticed too when I started keeping lizards more heavily, because I also kind of, when I got back into herpetoculture, it was really snake focused initially, and really fell in love with these Polychris that I started back with. And
that's so cool.
Of course, since then it's gone off the rails a little bit, but
as things do,
but yeah.
And then diet is the other thing I like constantly. I am like huge into like varied diets and so, yeah, I'm like constantly trying to find new weird things for them to eat, and see how it goes. They're primarily insectivores. And so the base for most of them is dubia. I've tried to do grasshoppers, but I have failed miserably at 2 attempts to keep grasshopper colonies going. It's just, I don't know. They're compared to roaches, they're so finicky. If you so much as like, you know, I think I bought a head of lettuce once that wasn't organic and it killed the whole colony. Just stuff like that. And so, for me, that hasn't, like, they're an amazing food source, but that one hasn't been, one that's panned out for me. But I do a lot of dubia. I'm working on lobster roach colonies right now.
Nice. Lobsters, nice soft-bodied roach.
Yeah, I tried red runners for a little bit, but never even got around to feeding them because they scared me so much. They're so fast.
They're really fast.
Like, I'm terrified they're going to get out and take over my house. So
yeah, they live up to the name.
Yes. Yes. So a lot of that. And then I feed quail.
Nice.
My favorite thing to feed them is quail ballots, like the fertilized, partially incubated eggs.
Mm-hmm.
They go crazy for that. Yeah. All sorts of fun stuff. So that's
very cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried like a mantids or phasmids, like stick insects with them? I bet they're
nuts. I haven't found, I guess, a source. At an affordable price point.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense.
But I would love them. I mean, yeah. I think katydids are the main thing they eat in the wild. So they would love it.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm just sending you a note right now.
Okay.
Or after the show. But
nice, cool.
anyway, I just distracted myself. I was going to ask you something about, this whole dynamic that you're talking about of just like trying to figure out how to like optimally utilize the enclosure space. Because again, a lot of stuff that I work with too is arboreal. You know, like my other room, it's my Guyana shield room, I call it. And it's like, I have the Polychrus and the puffing snakes in there. And then I also have another smaller species in the puffing snake complex as well in there, but they're all arboreals. And it's pretty much the same story, you know, that they utilize that top 50 to 40% of the enclosure, almost probably 90% of the time, you know, it's like, and for the lizards, even higher probably percentage than the snakes. And it's made me so curious about how do we optimally design enclosures, you know, and like make that space usable. Like one thing I've actually considered is actually instead of using that vertical space, actually trying to maximize the horizontal space and keeping my animals in
that.
Yeah. But like with the Polychrus, keeping them potentially in larger groups, mm-hmm. but with a lot more linear space where they can kind of separate out, and provided they're a lot smaller than tree monitors. So like each one could have their own little shrub, you know?
I really do think there's something to that.
Yeah. I think it would be more effective.
I was going to say I don't think that jungle canopy is something that you can reproduce in captivity.
No. Yeah. It's so true. You know,
the difference between 4 feet and 6 feet, that's nothing to an animal that spends its life in the canopy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At Reptilandia, they have a couple of tree monitor exhibits that are 2 stories tall. And the times I've been there, tree monitor is at the very tippy top of that 2-story every time I go. And it's no matter how much height you give them, that's where they're going to be.
Yep. Yeah. It was right at the top.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. It's one thing that I've tried to work with that is actually I do some mixed species of vivaria here. So I'll have
that's awesome.
I actually have lizards that live in with my Spilotes, which a lot of people are like, how the heck can you do that? They're going to eat your lizards. Cool. They don't eat the lizards. They're not interested in them, which is really cool. And I've had toads in with the Polychrus that live in the leaf litter and stuff like that. That's it's largely for me to be able to be okay, this whole space is being utilized. And it's of course, more interesting and fun.
Yeah, that's really cool.
I imagine that would be hard with tree monitors because they will eat anything, I imagine, but maybe not.
They would eat a lot probably.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've heard that the wild caught ones tend to be a little better about being willing to eat a variety of things.
Uh-huh.
And the captive ones tend to be more like, I just want to eat these things that I ate as a baby.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
That's interesting to try and experiment with totally. For somebody out there.
Yep. Yep.
something low risk at first, maybe.
Yeah.
But Well, very cool.
It's one of the things I love about this, and I'm sure you have it with yours as well, is just there's so much uncharted territory and so much that we just don't know.
Yeah.
And so that's where coming back to you know, behavioral observations and learning your animals and all of that becomes so hugely important, I think.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Are there like any specific ways in which you kind of like, you know, work with that? Are you like big on like note-taking and stuff like that or observations, or is it mostly just like...
I have a journal that I'll keep like some big notes in, but honestly, not enough. When I hatched out my black tree monitors, someone on Instagram reached out to me who's like keeping a spreadsheet of like hatching temps and hatch dates of like every tree monitor that basically has been hatched captively. And that was like amazing data to see and look at. But I don't know, I'm a lot more of like a qualitative mind than a quantitative mind. And so like, for me, like, I don't know, it's more, you know, oh, you're doing that today, that's interesting. Or, you know, I was expecting you to lay, but you're not using the lay box, let's figure out why. You know, that those kind of things, like that tends to be a little more what's interesting to me.
Yeah, it's interesting that I feel like some people have more of like, like the qualitative approach like you're talking about, and others have that more quantitative approach.
Which is wonderful. And, like, I love that data. And like, when I started
they're both valuable.
Yeah, when I started out with breeding the black tree monitors, like I was looking at papers and like, you know, the zoo accounts of the first breeding experiences and all of that kind of stuff. And so it's super, super, super important stuff. But yeah, I just, for whatever reason, tend to be garbage at keeping all of that kind of those specific notes. So
yeah, I try to keep good notes. Partially because I feel like a lot of the stuff I'm keeping, like there's just nothing out there about them. And so I feel like almost like a responsibility to try and contribute, you know, to herpetoculture more broadly. But I think it is more, my more natural state is more intuitive, you know, with my animals. And like I think that Phil, you know, my co-host here on the podcast, he's super intuitive as well. Like he often talks about, you know, like he has somebody who works with him there at the shop where he keeps his gyromastics, and he'll be like, you know, trying to instruct his employee about what to do. And then his employee will be like, okay, well, why? And he's like, I don't know. Like, it just seems like the thing to do today. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know, it's funny. It's like, it's like, you know, we're always, kind of like trying to balance it out, right? Because there's there is such a thing as being like, I think like just too by the seat of your pants, like not paying attention to like the quantitative stuff at all. But there's also like, I think a way in which if you're too focused in that quantitative realm and like the hard data, you can actually like, it can actually obscure your vision about what's happening right in front of you.
And you know, it's something that kind of evolved with my snake breeding as well. Like when I started out, like I had an ultrasound and I was using it and I was like measuring follicle development and all of that kind of stuff, like every inch of the way. And I haven't even used my ultrasound for a couple of years because it just got to the point where I was like, okay, that girl looks like she's doing X, Y, Z. She's at the front of her cage. She's hungry all the time. She's probably building, you know, oh, she's interested now and moving to the heat and coiling over there. Like, you know, she's probably getting close to ovulation. You saw like you learn all those little things to where it's like, I don't really need to know the specific data on it because I know what an animal looks like at this particular point in the process.
Yeah. And it can almost at a certain point, like all that data and stuff, it can become like a slog, you know, and it can actually like detract from the kind of like experience and like the immersive reality of keeping reptiles. I think that for a lot of us, you know, I don't know about what your experience is, but for me, a lot of my experience of tending to my reptiles, I'm just like in this immersive, you know, state of mind. It's like a similar as like to like being a creative practice, you know, if you're like painting or drawing where you're just like dropped in and you're just like, okay, I'm like this buddy over here needs that. And like this buddy over here needs this. And, you know, and it's kind of like this flow state almost.
It's funny that you say that because I think of a lot of it as like tapping that like creative expression, like.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard a lot of people like put voice to that. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. We like to geek out about that one on this show a lot. I think another thing that it kind of touches on for me is like, I call it like the tinkering impulse, yeah, or like the adaptive management impulse. This is something that like, you know, it's like for most of our like experience as a species on this planet, you know, when we were living in small like hunter-gatherer groups, it was like we're constantly in states of like adaptive management with our environment, you know, and like, yep. I think that in some ways herpetoculture like can like scratch that like vestigial itch that still exists in us, you know, from our Pleistocene origins.
I think there's something to that.
Yeah. I'm glad you're not just like, oh, that sounds kind of like craziness. No,
I totally think there's something to that.
Yeah. Cool. Well, okay. So I'm curious to pick your brain about some like broader things about herpetoculture and, so one, like, I guess like taking a broader view, what are some things about like herpetoculture right now and like the times that we're in that you find like exciting or interesting? I'm curious if anything comes to mind.
So the thing for me that I find really exciting is, you know, I got into this on the ball python side. A large number of my friends in the hobby are ball python people. And with the way that that particular, part of the hobby has evolved in terms of overproduction, difficulty selling animals, all of that kind of thing recently, a lot of my friends have started realizing, oh, all my eggs are in one basket. I need to find something else to get into as well. And so I've seen a whole lot of people find their own cool niche project to do alongside whatever that, you know, main bread and butter part of their business is. And to me, that's really exciting because I felt like for so long, you go to a show and it's like ball pythons and crested geckos. And, you know, that's about like 70% of what's there. And like, it had been feeling like there was less and less diversity over time. And I feel like the pendulum's starting to shift on that. And we're starting to move back to a place where there's more appreciation and interest in, just working with the weird stuff or working with stuff that maybe is a little bit more niche or, off the
beach. Yeah, totally. I feel like that's something that I've heard a few people kind of remark about in this moment, especially with this kind of like, I don't know, I think there's like a bit of market panic right now, like particularly coming from like the ball python sector, but also just generally. And I mean, I think it's very different depending on where you're situated within this broad expanse of herpetoculture. Because some people are just like, what are you talking about? Like, everything's the same for me, or things are better than ever for me, you know? And there's all types. So, but I do think that one of the things I've heard people say is that, like, it does kind of like, often it can change the kind of like, it can kind of weed out some of the folks who are interested in just like the financial aspect of it. Yeah. And I don't say that as like a slight to those people at all, but, cause I think that that's like a part of, again, a part of herpetoculture. And, but it is, there is something about like, you know, keeping for the passion of it and the excitement of it. And it's like, obviously like I can see like when you're talking about your tree monitors, like you're lighting up, you're passionate about them, you know, it's absolutely really, it's authentic. And that's, I think, I don't know. I think that there's just a lot of value in that. Like if everybody was like championing their own little weird niche species or genus or whatever, you know, with that kind of the same intensity and passion, it would be really cool.
It would be really cool to see that. I feel like there would be a lot more happy people in the hobby, at least.
Yeah, totally.
And I think it would be really good for the animals. Like, which exactly. At the end of the day, like what this is all about. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah,
that's so well said. So true. It's about the animals. Well, okay. So kind of staying with this same theme of like the more broad spectrum of herpetoculture. What is there like one thing that you wish you could change about herpetoculture where it's at right now? Like if you could just wave a magic wand.
I mean,
that one's a bit harder.
That one's hard. So I mean, I can think of a few specific things that I probably don't want to say because it's going to like make people hate me, but,
don't feel
so I'm not going to go after like a specific thing, like that, but, I mean, there's obviously things I would say, like, I think the thing that I would like to see improve that a lot of, and I think it's in the process of improving, but is the shift from quantity to quality. Like it's definitely, I feel like underway, but like, I feel like still we err so much on the side. Like, you know, like I was talking about, like you were talking about, like we're collectors, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So many of us like err on this side of like, gotta catch them all. And if we can dial that back and think, well, you know, maybe instead of having everything I like, I can have these three things I like, and I can like do up their enclosures amazing. And, you know, I think there's something to that that hasn't been as much in the forefront for a while.
So. Yeah, totally. I think that's well said. I mean, and honestly, that's like a better way of phrasing that too. It's like a more positive direction for it of like, what would you like to see improve, or like, where would you like things to go?
Yeah.
Rather than like what you don't like about what's right now. So I appreciate that. And I feel similarly. I feel like, I think that, I don't know, I'm always encouraging like younger folks in herpetoculture to like, who are kind of getting into it, you know, and really have like a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about it. I'm just like, just take your time. Just like go, you know, just like try and slow it down a little bit, you know, and it's not a race and you don't have to have every single thing. And
I think the other thing I would like to see is I'd like to see more keepers herping.
Yes. Because, okay. Yeah. So let's talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I feel like that's this whole other side of like the same thing that a lot of people are, I don't know, at least miss out on this, you know, way of appreciating, you know, finding an animal, being like, wow, that's cool, taking a picture and then letting it go about its merry little life. Like, I don't know. It's super fun. It gives you a different appreciation for the animals. It helps you understand better what natural habitats are like. The things that herping has taught me is that what I think is a great habitat often is not where I find the animals. I'm like, man, this is great habitat. There's got to be something.
It's like, wow, look at this stunning natural untouched landscape. And then it's like, oh, I saw like 50 snakes on the track in the trash pile at the edge of this and like none out here.
Right. You'll have like this amazing pile of rocks and where you'll see the snake is like crossing the gravel path. And you're like, really?
Yeah. We literally, I was just down in Pomona last month for the super show met up with some friends there. And we were all going to go out herping like on, I guess it was Friday night, like the night before the show. We were like, let's get out. Let's just try. It's like January, but like maybe we'll find something, you know, and make it worthwhile. And so we go out and like the place where we go is like, it was literally just like a dump. It was like this natural area where people had been going and just like throwing their old couches and like TVs and mattresses. And there were like dead goats and like it was kind of creepy and weird, but it was also like there's a lot of stuff to flip here. And it's like if you're gonna be looking for herps in January, you better be flipping, you know. A couple things, not much, but it was just funny because it was like it's also like a different kind of style of herping than like my introduction to herping was actually like just going hiking and like being like just more generally interested in nature and being a naturalist, you know, on some level. And and so still like most of the time it's kind of funny because more recently you know, I'll host friends like that I've made through the podcast and just through herpetoculture online community in general, that are in my area that want to go herping. And it's like, all right, let's go. And a couple times I've been out there, I've been like, oh, like you don't, like you're the way you're thinking of it is that like you want me to take you somewhere where we can like flip things.
Yeah.
Cause like we're not, like, you don't want to go like hike 6 miles and like hope that you'll see something crossing the trail.
I know. And that tends to be my mindset on it too, is like, I want to go on the hike and like see the thing in nature. Like,
yeah.
I don't really care about like the 18 boards you set out hoping
you
decide to camp out. I mean, that's, if you want to see animals, like it's definitely
a great way.
It's your way to see animals. And
yeah,
that's neat. There's a lot of animals that I haven't just randomly come across on a hike, but
yeah.
I don't know. I really appreciate the ones where you find them, like, you know, in situ in like a natural setting. Like, I don't know. That's really cool to me.
Yeah, I totally agree. I like it. I like it both ways. You know, I have a handful of sites now where I can go and kind of reliably flip stuff and find cool stuff and share it with friends from out of town and all that stuff. But yeah, for me, it's still, there's nothing better than being in the habitat that they would have been in, you know, 20,000 years ago.
Yeah. I don't know. Night hiking in general, I think is just, like there's something really, really special about it. And so I really, really love seeing herps, but like, I really also just like the excuse to get out at night and go hiking too.
Yeah. I love that as well. I used to do that a lot when I was younger, and these days where I live, it's a little scary to go night hiking.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do it by myself. I tend to do these things like when I'm on a trip with a group of people or something, not on a random Wednesday night.
Totally.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, do you have any like specific highlights, like a herping trip, maybe a herping trip?
Yeah.
And maybe like a specific herp.
Yeah. So herping trip, the one that I went on this past summer, I went to Guatemala.
Oh, wow.
Amazing. It was completely blew me away. I didn't have a great appreciation of the country, like going in, I just didn't know a lot about it.
Yeah.
And there's such a wide variety of different habitat types, like all within a relatively close area. So like, you know, you're up in a cloud forest and then 2 hours later, you're like in a dry desert type environment. And then a couple hours later, you're like hiking the side of a volcano. And it's just like really, really different stuff. And so, because of that, there's just this huge wide variety of different things we were able to see. Like we were able to see, like several palm pit viper species. Wow. Those were amazing. Super cool to find, like orifer and bicolor.
Wow.
So the really, really, really cool one was we stayed at this Gila Derma research facility, and we found two Guatemalan beaded lizards. And
okay, call them dragons. They're dragons.
I don't know why I did that. Like, I don't know, but
I feel like it's appropriate. So.
And there's only like, you know, a couple hundred of them in the wild. And we found two animals while we were there. And one of them had never been tagged before. And that was really, that was so freaking cool. That was definitely like one of my really big highlights, was getting to have that experience.
That's amazing. Yeah. Guatemala is like, I mean, Mexico, Guatemala are both like really high on my list for places that I want to experience, just because, like you said, there's such an incredible variety of like habitat types. And because it's like, I don't know, I was talking to somebody about like Mexico in particular, and it's got such incredible complex geography that if you were to like flatten Mexico out, flatten out all the mountains, it would be like huge because it's just so mountainous and so, and because of that,
incredibly diverse ecosystems.
Exactly. And because of that, you get all of this endemism, you know, all of these species that are just like literally like, oh, this species is on this slope of this mountain and that's it.
Yeah.
You know,
particularly when you get into like all the little Abronia species and all of that. It's just, it's pretty wild.
Yeah. It's just so cool. So cool.
Yeah.
Do you also do some domestic herping as well? Is it mostly
like mostly I do some, like I have some areas I hit up locally. But usually for me, like domestically, it tends to be a lot more of the, I'm going on a hike and checking rocks and stuff while I'm hiking. I really want to go to Arizona. I haven't done Arizona.
Nice.
Like I really want to, go out and find rattlesnakes and gilas and all that fun stuff. But
it's as advertised.
That's what, I mean, it's like this, internationally renowned like herping destination that we just happen to have in the US.
It's so special. I mean, every time I'm in Southern Arizona, I'm just like, what am I doing in California? I got to move to Southern Arizona. But I think if I did that, I would just become like a herping bum.
one of my friends who's like probably the best herper I know, like happens to live in Arizona. And it's like, well, I mean, you spent your whole, like you spent all this time like looking around, finding stuff. Like you can just, it's crazy. But yes. Yeah. But I've done a lot of international trips. That's been one of the big things that I've been doing the past few years. I've gotten really into wildlife photography. And
very cool.
Yeah, and enjoy that a lot.
Do you have any intentions or plans for a tree monitor focused international trip at any point?
It would be amazing. I came really close to at least doing one with some monitors recently. We were looking at Borneo and Komodo, but just a few different things lining up, I wasn't able to make it happen. I mean, it would be amazing to see tree monitors someday. That would definitely be pretty incredible. There are a few people who have gone on trips fairly recently.
Yeah.
To go see stuff. So yeah, someday that would be real
possible.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we've been going for a little over an hour and I want to be respectful of your time, but I've got a couple more questions if you're cool with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one thing I'm curious about is just like for you personally, like do you have any specific goals with herpetoculture moving forward that you're focused on, or are you just kind of in a state of like, okay, I'm kind of like rebuilding my collection, more lizard focused. What's that look like for you right now?
Yeah. So I've got a few specific projects that I'm really focused on. One is the black tree monitors. I'm keeping the entire first clutch that I have. I've got my pair that produced them. I recently picked up a trio of wild caught animals. And then I have a pair of captive ones coming in from Canada. So my goal is to get like a really genetically diverse group, hopefully have multiple animals producing and be able to, be able to offer other people genetically diverse captive animals. Like that's a really big deal to me. That's something that is like, I'm in it for the long haul, like 10 years from now, I'm hoping to, still be working on it. One of the other projects I'm working on is Similis monitors. I freaking love them. I have two females and a male. My male is fully grown and he's an enormous beast of a boy. And my girls are both still pretty small, so I have some time to go on them. But they're probably my favorite non-tree monitors right now. They just have a lot of personality and they're so pretty. So those are a couple of my big ones. I am also working with a few kind of more locality spiny-tailed iguana species. And I'd really like to, and that's, that's one that's just I really like them. Like I'm working with the Motagua Valley ones from Guatemala now, having gone to their location, I got really into them. I also have Roatans. And so that's something that I'm like excited to play around with in the future too. But yeah, I mean, really, those are kind of the big things for me right now where I really want to focus, focus stuff. And then I've got all sorts of other weird ones. I've got like little Colodes lizards and,
oh, cool. Yeah.
And a few other things too. But yeah, the monitors are probably the biggest priority for me.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I can understand that. I feel like for a lot of folks, once they're keeping monitors, it's like the rewards in terms of just like interaction and like, yeah, their cognitive capacity and just all of that it seems to get people.
Yes. Yeah, it does.
They get ensnared and they can never leave.
Once you're caught, you're just stuck. So I hope to be working with them for a really long time.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, all right. I think that leads me to our closer question, I think. Yeah. Then. Which is the same for every guest, and it is why herpetoculture? And I guess when I say that, I mean, why do you do it? Why is it rewarding for you? You know, what makes it such a compelling thing that you want to dedicate all this time and life and energy to?
Yeah. I think that herps are incredible, profoundly underappreciated animals by the general public. They're fascinating. There's so many different types of them. And then there's also just this element of like, I don't know that I could necessarily like verbally express why herps. It's just because they like crawled into my heart and like got stuck there. And it's not really necessarily like a rhyme or reason as to like why it happened. It just did. Mm-hmm. And I caught the bug and it's just there.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like there's something that's like really hard to define about it, or like, but it's like, I don't know. I think that there's something that herpetoculture and just like herpetofauna meet in us that like nothing else really does.
Yeah. You know?
It's like the closest way I can verbalize it maybe, but very cool.
Like it gives me this way to like, I don't know, relate to nature, relate to the world. That's just different than it was before. I don't know.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, this has been such a pleasure chatting with you. Same. I really appreciate your time. And where can folks find you on social media if folks are interested in inquiring about stuff in the future that you might be producing available for sale?
Yeah.
How can they find you?
Corey Martin Reptiles. I'm on Instagram and Facebook. And you can find me there.
Cool. I'll have links for everybody in the show notes. And thanks again. I'm going to hit the button.